welcome to the Wing Women podcast, hosted by best friends and journalists, Frankie Gradden, that's me, and Charlie Gowans-Eglinton, that's her. Hey, Chaz.
Hi, Franks, how are you?
I'm very well, my dear. How are you?
Yeah, trucking along.
Trucking along. I like your new pen.
Thanks. It's green. It's the highlight of, today at least, I'd say.
What have you been up to, my dear?
Well, I went out for dinner.
To a real-life restaurant?
To a real-life restaurant.
So oh, my
went
God.
To Campagna and Jones, just off Columbia Road, Flower Market. We booked on Tuesday night, and we sat outside, which I think was key to me feeling not stressed about this. And it was lovely. It was really lovely. They were really careful about everything being really sanitary. You had to ask before you went to the loo. They'd nip off and do a final sanitise and then come and get you, and you were allowed to go to the loo.
Did you have to stick your hand up and say?
Well, yeah, I walked to the front door and said, can I go to the loo? And then they came back for me. I'd been really wanting to go and really wanting to support local restaurants, but I was also just thinking, is it mad to try and go to a restaurant, and am I just playing into Boris's hands, boosting the economy but at the cost of a second wave? But it felt really safe, and hopefully it was safe, and it was just lovely to eat something that I haven't cooked myself, eat something that I haven't planned in advance 5 hours earlier, and just have a glass of wine. It kind of felt like being on holiday or something. I felt a bit giddy because I hadn't done it in so long. If the weather holds, or I mean, it's horrid today, isn't it? We're recording on Thursday. But if the weather gets a bit nicer and we do have a bit of a balmy summer, it would make such a huge difference, wouldn't it? Because people were eating inside, but I'm just not sure how I would have felt. They really distanced the tables inside, obviously, as they have to. And as they should. And I wonder if other people are feeling anxious about it, because I've noticed a few of our favourite local restaurants sharing on Instagram that they're having a lot of no-shows.
And yeah, I've seen that. It's really sad.
Over 50% of their tables on any given night aren't showing up. And obviously everyone's doing pre-bookings only. No one's allowing walk-ins. So that means they're just losing that income for the night. And after 3 or 4 months closed, they can't afford to lose half of their income for the night. It's already going to be really difficult for restaurants to even break even, because the rent that they're paying, the square footage and then staff costs and food costs and all of that, when you're seating half or a third of the guests you normally would, because you're sanitising the tables before and after, because everyone has to be seated further apart, that must be incredibly difficult for them to make a living. And then for people to not be turning up. I imagine some of those people are just panic then on the night that they don't want to be sat inside a restaurant. But for a lot of people, it's probably booking loads of places so they've got somewhere to go if they want, and then choosing not to. But bad form.
Yeah, it is very naughty. So did you feel like you could switch off? Did you almost feel like, I feel like we've massive overuse of the word normal over the past few months, but did you feel back to quote unquote normal when you were dining? Could you almost forget that we are in a pandemic?
Yeah, a little bit. The reason we're obsessed with saying back to normal and when will it be normal is because that's what we're all craving, some degree of normality, and we haven't had that in ages. And yes, there was a degree of normality, and just drinking a glass of wine and having a laugh and eating some delicious pasta. It was surprisingly lovely, and I was surprisingly relaxed in the situation. Have you been oot and a boot in Devon?
I have been indulging in some extreme sports, Charles.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm not a sporty gal.
No, well.
I'm definitely not an extreme sporty gal. But as promised on last week's podcast, we got the paddleboard out and I dipped my toes in the sea. I say sea, it's an estuary. So it's not quite as rough and ready as the sea, and it's incredibly shallow, which I think is wise when attempting to get on a paddleboard for only the second time.
Does that also mean it's a bit warmer?
It is warmer, And the estuary where I am has got a lovely mud floor, which feels delicious on your toes. Like a wee foot massage. Ooh,
that makes me feel a bit... That's kind of giving me the ick, you saying that.
Yeah, it's kind of gross, but it's also squidgy and lovely. So yes, got the paddleboard out. So I bought Ben a paddleboard last year for Crimbo with the ambition that we would get it out on the estuary and go from pub to pub. There's lots of pubs in my area where I am. So we attempted to go from one pub to the other. It's only about 50 yards. In walking time, I'd say it's 3 minutes. In paddleboarding time, about 45.
Yeah.
It's difficult getting two people on one paddleboard. Well, three people, because there's a person in my tum who is weighing me down. But we did it. We did it. There was lots of onlookers, so it was sort of mortifying, but also hilarious. I fell in. But it was fine. And then we read on the bottom of the paddleboard when we finished, only meant to put one person on it. So we flouted the rules, but we had fun.
I love this. Paddleboard pub crawl could really catch
on. Do you know what I mean? There's a third one you could reach by paddleboard as well. So the Olympics is cancelled, but don't worry, because we'll introduce the paddleboard pub crawl.
Maybe that's a good way to socially distance as well, because if you're drinking your pint on a paddleboard in an estuary, you're not within distance of anyone.
You're not.
Perhaps you could bring in the favourite thing you've ever said to me, which is that you, on a canal in Amsterdam, found a pizza place that hands you pizza out of the window. I haven't been, but your story has stayed with me. Now I'm imagining you eating pizza on the paddleboard.
It's the dream. And actually, on a holiday in Malta, there's a place called the Blue Lagoon, and ice creams come around on a boat. It's a little ice cream boat.
Wow.
So maybe this is Mel... Is it Mel Gibson, Waterworld? Maybe it's this.
Oh, I love that film.
Maybe that was predicting what life was going to be. Mentioning drinking on a paddleboard, there were two women. I was seriously impressed with this. I mean, the paddleboard game here is strong.
Right.
There's like four people and a dog on a paddleboard. It is amazing. And there were two women. One was doing the paddling. One was sat on the front with a big glass of wine. So it is a thing. People are doing it.
So that's what you were visualising when you imagined you and Ben.
Yeah.
What went
wrong?
We're
not at that stage.
What went wrong? Why did you fall in?
Well, you have to have the balance of a ballerina on a paddleboard. And you also need to have core strength, which at the moment I just do not have. So Ben was having to do all the core strength for two of us. And I got too scared to take my legs out of the water. So I was sort of anchoring us down. I mean, I was almost, my feet could sort of touch the ground. So I was almost just walking us along on the paddleboard. But it was great fun. It was so much fun. And I've also been on an electric bike this week as well.
Sipping all
absolutely
over the place.
Tearing up the area. It's the new face of cycling. I'm crap on a bike. I've got no strength in my body. Get an electric bike. Zooming all over the place.
Magico. Speaking of pubs, what are you drinking?
So, my non-alcoholic wine adventures continue. I have got Sainsbury's alcohol-free rosé. Get this. £2.75.
Well, what is it though? Juice? It's just some juice.
I think it's just water with some food colouring in, to be honest.
How big is the bottle, £2.75? Like a wine bottle?
75 centilitres.
Okay.
Full bottle.
Does it look like a Côte de Provence? Is it in a shapely bottle?
It's in a slightly bog standard bottle. Right. There's a screw top. The colour, though, I will say, is that lovely pale peachy rosé. So you could almost pretend like you're drinking a legitimate rosé. I mean, taste-wise, it's not that developed. It's not that nuanced. I'm not getting flavours from the hedgerows.
I thought you were just going to say, I'm not getting flavours.
I'm just not getting flavours in general. But look, by the time you put some ice cubes in and you put it in a nice glass, bish, bash, bosh.
Okay.
How about you?
I'm drinking alcoholic wine, but we've done a supermarket special this week. Ooh. Because mine is It's a screw top. It's M&S, Atlantis. It's from Santorini, Greece. I'm just looking to see if... Oh, here we go. God, I'm really going to struggle to say this one. Acirtiko grape. I mean, that doesn't sound Greek, does it? Acirtiko. No? Okay, well, I'm sure that's exactly how they say it in Santorini. Sourced from 60-year-old vines that cling in low bushes to the island's mineral-rich volcanic soil. Oh, they're missing an apostrophe there on islands. Anyway, it's from 2018. It's aromatic, zingy and crisp. Not my words. Yummy would be my word. It's really good. Especially good with a bit of seafood. I had it yesterday. That's why you didn't hear a particularly good opening of the screw top, because I had some for dinner. I had it with a halloumi and peach and rosemary salad.
Oh, yum, Charles. Yeah. That sounds delicious.
So, cheers.
Cheers.
What else has been catching your attention this week?
You must have seen this, but I've been seeing a lot of coverage about Britney Spears, particularly the Free Britney campaign. So I actually saw this first on Diet Prada's Instagram, and they had reposted some information about the Free Britney campaign. This has been rolling for a couple of years. So it relates to her conservatorship, which she has had since 2008. And essentially that's a legal guardianship, which means she can't do a lot of things without permission.
And it's her dad, right?
It was her dad for 11 years. And last year it switched over to a lady called Jodie Montgomery, who is a care manager.
Oh, I didn't know that it had switched.
Yeah, so she does that. So it normally gets used for people who are very, very old, who have dementia, who have serious mental health problems and aren't deemed to be able to make decisions by themselves. So Britney's had this put on her. This is all reportedly. Britney has never spoken out about the details of this. So this is all just what is reported and speculated. But apparently she can't leave the house. She can't make phone calls. She can't spend her money. So many things without getting permission, initially from her dad and now from this lady called Jodie.
I think the reason it seems so disgusting is, if she was really not capable of making these decisions and living her life as she chooses, then how is she going on tour? If she's that vulnerable, she wouldn't be able to be working. And I think that's what people are balking at, isn't it? That we're being told she's so vulnerable that she can't make her own decisions at all. She needs to run it by someone if she wants to get in the car. But it's perfectly okay for her to go on TV and make cameos in films.
So this post that was regrammed on Diet Prada states, since the conservatorship began, she has released 4 albums, done 3 worldwide tours, a 4-year residency at Vegas, was a full-time judge on The X Factor, released multiple perfumes and a lingerie line, made $138 million or so a year. So it just seems such a drastic measure. She's 38 years old. By the sounds
of
these...
It's pretty 38.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my goodness, when did we get so old?
Britters. By the sounds of it, she is, under house arrest. I follow her on Instagram and look at her videos of her dancing and painting. They are quite, what's the word? They are very unfiltered for a celebrity's social media output. And she has had various comments that aren't particularly nice about them. And actually she spoke out recently and just said, look, this is me being authentic and as real as it gets. I want to inspire people to do the same and just be themselves without pleasing others. That's the key to happiness. So that's very much her message. But a few reports that I've read has pointed out, if all the details of this conservatorship is to be believed, making Instagram videos is pretty much the only thing she can do. And actually, if all the details are correct, then someone else has to post them on her social media account because she actually can't post anything on social media on her own.
I was going to say, I'm surprised she's actually allowed access to social media.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe someone's filming her and then just puts them up. There is a piece on Grazia by Bonnie McLaren, which is questioning whether we should be talking about Britney's mental health, whether we should be speculating over it, because it is such a private issue and this woman has had so much of her life exposed and picked apart, that should this be left to her and to deal with in a private way? But by the sounds of it, what fans are worried about is the conservatorship gets reviewed again on the 22nd of August this year, which is why we've had a sort of surge in the Free Britney movement. So people are worried that she's being held there against her will and are taking action to see if something can be done, something can be looked at properly. Because if she is, then this is a real tragedy.
And this is always the thing with child stars, isn't it? Because very rarely do you get a child star who comes out of it and is just like, great decision, mum and dad. Definitely haven't had my childhood just stolen from me. No. So then you do wonder how she's been put in this position of this conservatorship, if she would be so vulnerable, if she would need so much support, if she would need someone else to exert so much control over her life, if she hadn't aged 7 or 8 or whatever, been signed up to the Mickey Mouse Club.
I mean, what it's really made me think about is celebrity culture and our obsession with fame. And we've had this obsession with fame for so long. And yet, as you say, we've had so many people go through the fame game, especially at a young age, and been cautionary tales for the dangers of it. We know that having that exposure to the public is not good for your mental health. You are so open to exploitation and manipulation. There seems to be so little protection for these people. And yet, still now in 2020, fame and celebrity is the ultimate achievement, right? That is the goal. I was watching a rerun of Love Island last night. Not sad at all.
Which season? What we're talking about?
Well, it was on ITV2 and it was Love Island, All the Drams. So they'd done a compilation of the most dramatic moments of the last however many series there have been.
Wow, sir. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it was great. But I was thinking, all of these people, and okay, their motivation might be that they've come on to legitimately find love.
Sure.
I slightly struggle with that. And I think probably it's because you want to boost your social media following and potentially get a signing with Misguided or Boohoo or whatever one of those wants to give them a range and pop them in their next ad campaign. This is still so, so sought after. And in the age of social media, it's almost easier to be famous, isn't it? Social fame is just, it happens overnight. And it's like no one's heeded all of these warning signs. And we've seen social media stars get torn down. This cancel culture that we've got at the moment in society is just terrifying. You perceive to have misstepped once and then that's it. You're over overnight. And I just don't know how you would deal with that. Often these people are also so young. I'm 32 and if I received comments or was told I was cancelled, I would be mortified. So how do you do that when you're 22? How do you do that when you're 18? You know, these people are just so young. And it just astounds me sometimes that people are still so drawn to it. And there's obviously such an allure there that makes it very easy to ignore the potential pitfalls.
I think so much of it is the wealth divide, though, because we've always had an extreme wealth divide. But social media has given us an opportunity to see exactly how different life can be when you are incredibly wealthy. And the people that we see on social media who are incredibly wealthy are also famous. Obviously, that wealth isn't always hand in hand with fame, but we see them together. It's like at the beginning of lockdown, remember that smugsalation thing of Ellen DeGeneres comparing time in lockdown to time spent in prison while sat in a $20 million house, and videos of J-Lo's kids by the pool that looks like a hotel pool, this huge garden and this huge pool, and you started to see how different your life could be. And I can see very much how somebody with no expectation of reaching that level of wealth through their chosen career, I mean, I don't see how I can buy a house. I couldn't unless my circumstances changed drastically. And actually, I'm incredibly privileged compared to a lot of people. And I'm incredibly privileged to be able to afford to live in London, to be able to afford a one bed flat. And when you see those extremes of wealth and how extremely different your life could be, if you're sat in a bedsit during lockdown looking on Instagram at JLo's house and thinking, well, JLo didn't grow up with money. She's openly spoken about how she didn't grow up with money. And then you see TikTok stars who actually, as you say, become famous overnight. And the old celebrity, you did have to have talent. You had to be a great actor or a singer or a dancer. You don't really need any of those things now. You just need to pour a lot of time into whatever your niche is. And people are making a lot of money from all sorts of things on social media and achieving that degree of fame.
I do think we are particularly bad in the UK. Our media is very guilty of having that build them up, tear them down culture. And we've seen that through tabloids and papers, but I think we're also seeing it very much on social media. And I do think that media as a whole has got to take a bit of responsibility for the people that we thrust into the limelight. And I do think the fame game, the media circus that comes with it, is particularly hard on women. Women's appearances picked apart in a way that a man's isn't. Women's behaviour is scrutinised in a way that a man's isn't. And I'm not saying that blokes are immune to it, they're not at all. But I do think it's particularly bad for women. So if we're going to keep making these instant celebs, then I think it's our duty, really, as decent humans, to start taking care of them a little bit more and to not treat them quite so other and just have a bit more humanity about it.
Well, and to look at cancel culture as well. There's been quite a lot about that in the press over the last week. Some of those more public examples of somebody using their platform to share a point of view that is discriminatory, yes, I do think people should call them out. I completely agree with that. But I think you're also seeing, especially these quite vulnerable teenagers and 20-somethings, as you say, who have found social media fame, can then be cancelled by one of their friends in a sort of peer group falling out. What you used to have at school when you'd say, oh, I don't like you anymore, I don't want to be your friend anymore. Now they tear each other apart. And then people who've never met them and don't know them from all across the world will join in to pile on someone.
Well, and also, and I'm not excusing any behaviour, but if we are going to thrust people who have not had any experience of fame, who have done something, filmed a video in their bedroom and suddenly reached these heady heights, if we're going to thrust them in the spotlight, why are we surprised that their views are not developed properly or informed properly and they're not educated views? Why? Of course they're not going to be, not necessarily. These aren't role models. These are young people who have just all of a sudden woken up with a hell of a lot of followers. Why do we assume that they're then going to be role models?
I read a really interesting piece in this month's Elle called "It Took One 48-Word Tweet Sent on My Morning Commute, Then Less Than an Hour Later I Had Been Cancelled." This was by a writer called Natasha Tynes, and she lived in Washington, and she tweeted a picture of a woman in a Metro uniform eating something out of a styrofoam box. And you're not supposed to eat on the trains. She tweeted it out to her 10,000 followers. The woman that she shamed on social media for eating was black. And the tweeter herself, Natasha, is a woman of colour. That's how she describes herself in her piece. But she was called out for racism and bigotry. She was also called a terrorist, she says, a jihadi, an aeroplane bomber. She was told to go back where she came from. So she was then also the victim of racism. Within a few days of sharing this tweet, the author's debut book, which was due to be out 4 weeks later, was cancelled. Her publisher withdrew publication of her debut book. And it was a really interesting look at what it's like to be that person on the other side. And I'm not condoning her tweet, and it certainly seems to me to fall in with that kind of Karen American thing of complaining to the manager and wanting to get everyone in trouble. And I don't understand why it was her business. And I don't know if there was racial motivation there. I only have this article to go on that she has written. So I certainly don't condone that behaviour of trying to get a woman to lose her job because she's eating something on the train. I think that's pretty disgusting behaviour. Why did she feel that she needed to intervene? And why do people feel that they have a right to police other people's every movement if it isn't interfering with them? But it was a really interesting piece on cancel culture and what it is like to be cancelled.
Well, it's just like at the moment, there's this other regulating body above the law that can dictate a person's life. There's this other societal set of rules that we are living by. What are you thinking about this week, Chaz?
Well, I told you that I had a lovely dinner. I also went to a socially distanced birthday party in the park on Saturday. Six or eight people sat on their own picnic blankets. There was a cake. Just in case anybody says Charlie went to a rave and cancels me for that behaviour. I didn't. So I have been seeing people much more. And this has all been wonderful. And when I was in the darkness of lockdown, living alone and feeling incredibly isolated and incredibly lonely and really craving people, this was what I hoped for. This is what I dreamed of, that we would be able to get back to this point where I would be able to sit in a park with my friends when we were on Zoom calls and lacking that, actually having someone there in person. And when you're trying to have a proper discussion with someone, a catch up with a friend and really pouring your heart out, and then there's a glitch and you lose each other or they can't really hear you. This was what I longed for. And I think for anyone living alone, but also for people, you know, living perhaps not with their nearest and dearest, the isolation was just so hard. And then, as soon as I'm allowed to do these things, it's like I've forgotten how to socialise. I've completely lost my people stamina, and I am calling it people fatigue, which I made up, but that's what I have. I have people fatigue because it's exhausting and I'm out of the habit. I'm out of the habit of having to be in a big group conversation where multiple people are talking and you pitch in. And I find myself either just being really quiet and just listening and watching, or just feeling exhausted, because actually Zoom calls and everything are quite a short period of time. Even if you sit on them over dinner, you're kind of doing your own things and you can just get up and go and make yourself a drink. People kind of zone in and out, don't they? Especially if you're on quite a relaxed Zoom call where everyone's doing their own thing and you might check your phone or you might read an email or you might be on social media at the same time. So having to be really present in a moment because you're actually in person, I'm finding it exhausting. And that's ridiculous, because this is what I wanted more than anything else, and I'm finding it exhausting.
But I guess also because we're going through those first meetings with so many people, you haven't really properly seen them in months. You're doing that really intense catch up where you're like, okay, tell me everything about yourself that's been happening for the last 3-4 months. So it's quite a overwhelming experience. But I completely know where you're coming from. I remember when we had our first person to the garden, to sit at the other end of the garden to have a chat. And I mean, obviously I live with Ben, so we'd been talking, but there was this new person that had come into the dynamic. I mean, not a new person, a friend we've known for ages. We hadn't seen him. We didn't really know what he'd been up to. We had so much to catch up on. I couldn't think of a thing to say. Honestly, my conversation skills had just gone out the window. I thought we'd be talking over ourselves, gabbling and gabbling along. And I just thought, I've forgotten how to do this. I have absolutely nothing to say to you. And I think the funny thing is you think you've got so much to catch up on. And then you're saying, OK, well, what have you been up to? Well, of course, everyone's just been on the sofa or working from home, doing exactly the same thing that you've been doing. So actually, at that time, there wasn't much to catch up on at all. Such a weird feeling.
Well, that's the thing. Nobody has funny anecdotes. Nobody's been travelling. Nobody's been to a new restaurant. What do you have? Nothing, really. So you're caught up in a matter of moments. And then you just have to attempt fun conversation again. I'm out of the habit of fun conversation. I don't know how to do that anymore.
I've definitely found that I think I've learnt how to do more and feel more comfortable by myself or in a smaller social situation. So I've always been worried that I don't have this huge group of friends. I can't book out a private room in a pub and have tables and tables of friends for dinner. I just don't have that many friends. I don't know how people maintain all of those friendships.
Well, you've really gone, you've gone for quality over quantity, I think we could safely say.
I have, and I've gone small, and I've always been a bit, I've thought, oh, I've maybe felt a bit embarrassed about that, or just thought, oh God, am I not a particularly nice person? But I've become much more comfortable that that's my situation over the past few months because I've only been able to see a small handful of people. And that's been completely great and completely, I've coped, you know, like yeah. It hasn't been that I've been searching for other people to see. By the time I've seen my friends, by the time I've seen my family, that's kind of enough. And I feel like it's taught me that that's okay. And that actually time by yourself is okay. Again, I think because we're in this social media world where there's all these connections on Instagram, it's on Twitter, it's on WhatsApp, you're always connecting and always feeling like you need to be messaging. We're probably out of the practice of just being alone or with a small amount of people in a quality capacity. And I feel like this experience has taught me how to do that again. And that's okay. I don't feel that pressure to be seeing a million people and to be making a million plans. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. How are you feeling about now staying in your parents' house because it's been just you and Ben for so long? Is that a struggle? I mean, obviously it's lovely, but do you find that exhausting at all, having to be present with more people? And I guess your parents as well want to catch up and hear all about the pregnancy. Have you found that tiring?
It's always weird being an adult and then go and living with your parents, isn't it? Because you don't realise it, but you cultivate your own routines and your own way of doing things. And then when you're back with anybody, actually, it's like when you go on holiday with a friend. And you suddenly realise that you've got completely different ways of doing things. And you're like, oh, that's weird. So there's definitely elements of that. But I think because we're just keeping it to the four of us, it seems a bit more manageable. So it's almost like maybe if you do it in increments of just introducing people in a slightly gradual way, then maybe that feels a little bit more manageable and not quite so overwhelming. But yeah, it is very strange suddenly having three people to talk to and not just one person to talk to. And I can only imagine how odd it will feel for people going back into an office scenario, for example. And okay, we know that offices aren't going to be full to capacity, probably. But to suddenly have even just five people, six people in a room, weird, completely weird.
I think I just need to relearn the art of conversation because we've gotten to a point with Zoom calls and everything that as soon as you've said all that you wanted to say, or even just as soon as you start to feel a bit tired and like you could just go and watch TV, you can just be like, right, I've got a dash, or I've got another call, or I said I'd ring my mum, or I better start making some dinner. And when you're somewhere in person, you can't just be like, right, I've had enough now of people time.
Bye.
I'd like to immediately end this here. Stop speaking. You can't.
No.
You can't just be like, I just need to be quiet now. So I think I just need to relearn how to be around people. That sounds stupid, but...
It doesn't. I think lots of people are going to be feeling that way, Chaz.
Anywho's, what are your recommendations this week, Franks?
So, I've got a couple of interviews I would like to recommend. So, the first one is in US Vogue, and it's the cover interview, and it's by Abby Aguirre, and it's an interview with Simone Biles. Have you read this?
I haven't, no.
OMG. I remember watching... Now, what Olympics was it? Is it 2016 the most recent, or are they every 2 years? Was it 2018?
I don't really... Don't ask me sports questions.
I know, I'm sorry. We're both as bad as each other.
I don't even watch them.
Not even the gymnastics?
No.
Oh, I adore watching the gymnastics. And I remember the first time I watched Simone Biles, and it was amazing. She is incredible. Everybody knows this. She's the most decorated gymnast in world championship history. 23 years old. She's so phenomenal that she has had moves named after her. She's incredible. Anyway, Vogue have put her on the cover. There's this huge interview with her, and it's just so interesting. It goes right back to her childhood and talks about all the sacrifices she made to train to Olympic level. And I think any sports people's stories are, I find, incredibly interesting. As I've already said, I'm not sporty. I don't watch a lot of sport. But that level of dedication and commitment and self-control to get yourself to this peak level is just awesome. And it happens at such a young age. She started gymnastics at a really super young age and had the passion for it and the drive to get herself to where she is today. It's amazing. So the interview charts her journey. I hate that word, it's so cheesy, isn't it? But it charts her journey from childhood up to now, and she's globally famous and she's widely regarded as the most successful gymnast in the world in history. She also talks about how she's dealt with trolls who have made comments about her body, her appearance. She talks a little bit about the racism she's encountered by other gymnasts in the industry. What is very interesting is she talks about Larry Nassar, and he was the USA team doctor who sexually abused the Olympic team, including Biles. And she talks really openly about the emotional impact of that, the fact that she suffered depression, the fact that she didn't want to talk about it, because if she spoke about it, it was like she was admitting it had happened, and she was so scared to let people down because she is this role model. She didn't want to let people down to say, you know, this thing has happened to me. But she did speak out, and she's become incredibly vocal about him and what has happened, but also the organisation that allowed it to happen.
Watching those testimonies at his trial at the time, just heartbreaking, but also amazing to see these young women be able to use their voices. It was so powerful.
I think what's apparent, which is so scary, is that there were so many people around him who were aware of it happening. And these people were in positions of authority, and they were meant to look after these athletes. These girls are young, they're in their teens, and they knew it was happening, or they had an inkling that it was happening, and nobody did anything. And obviously now they have, and action has happened, and Simone has been incredibly instrumental in all of that. And then she also talks about just the impact of the Olympics having been cancelled. So they're next year now, which you think, oh, okay, fine, they're just next year. But for an athlete who has trained, and they talk about how precise a training schedule is, and you chart the peak of your performance and it coincides with the big competition that's happening. So for all of these athletes who have been on this really, really strict regime to suddenly have it bumped back a whole year, it screws everything up. Simone was actually meant to retire this year, so she will be 24 this year, which, madly, is old for a gymnast. So she has to keep going, and the training schedules are punishing, and she has to keep going with that. She has to avoid injury for a whole year. Mentally, you have to somehow get your head around keeping on going for another year. And she just talks about the struggle that that has been, and actually they speak to her mom, who says when it was announced that the Olympics had been postponed, just the grief and the sense of loss that Simone experienced was just monumental. It's such a good interview. She's such a fascinating person, and she is a real inspiration. So I would definitely, definitely recommend reading that, and then just YouTubing every single performance that's ever been filmed of her, because she's just, in the interview, the interviewer, Abby, talks about, and I'm paraphrasing massively because I'm not looking at the interview, but she talks about how Simone has a completely different relationship with gravity, and you watch her and then all of a sudden she'll just spring and do these double backflips, twirls, la la la, and it's like she just isn't affected by gravity. She's just in this completely different realm. And it is when you watch her, it just absolutely blows your mind to think that a human being can do that with their body. Anyway.
Sounds cracking. What's your next one?
So my next one is another interview. So this is on the cover of Vanity Fair, and this is Viola Davis. The interview is by Sonia Saria, and actually the pictures have been shot by Dario Calmes, who is the first black photographer to shoot the cover of Vanity Fair.
Which is shocking, isn't it?
2020, yeah. So again, great interview, really honest, really open. She talks about growing up in poverty with an alcoholic and at times violent father. She talks about being at school and being made to feel very different and not being taught her heritage, not being taught her history. This is an argument that is still going, but the curriculum is still very bent towards white history. And she mentions how what she was taught painted the black community and slaves as, well, she actually mentions here that they learned that they were illiterate. And fortunately, she had a teacher who took her and her sister to the Rhode Island Black Heritage Society and showed them examples of powerful black people, of intelligent black people. And she says, we sat there for hours and we cried. We cried the entire time. It was the first time she had been shown positive examples of people that looked like her. She talks about when she went to Juilliard, the drama school. Again, it was set up that it didn't really acknowledge her. She said it was very Eurocentric. And then she talks about The Help. So The Help was, I mean, really, it was the first film that I came across her. And it was the one that made her a household name, right?
It was a huge film.
It was a huge film.
Which is now coming under some fire because white saviour complex.
Exactly. And it has been criticised for a very reductive view of race relations. And Viola has said that she does regret being part of that. She said, there's a part of me that feels like I betrayed myself and my people because I was in a movie that wasn't ready to tell the whole truth. And what is incredibly interesting also is, considering the huge success of The Help, whilst it raised her profile, she says that it didn't open the floodgates to more acting roles. She's done a lot of television and there would be comments, you know, oh, why have you gone into television and not more film? And she said, well, just weren't any roles. And she does talk about how there are so many roles for white actors, but for black actors, there are just not, especially black female actors. That's my lot. What are your recs?
I've been watching, and admittedly, a lot of it's been on social media, but I've been watching a bit of comedy. So the comedy industry wasn't mentioned at all in the emergency arts funding briefing that the government gave. So they're providing $1.5 billion, but comedy wasn't mentioned. And apparently nearly half of comedy clubs say that they will face permanent closure without some kind of funding or support. As with all of the arts, it's an area that's been hit incredibly hard and is now being overlooked. And I think that's rubbish. My mum was a stand-up comic when I was a kid, and it is such a brilliant craft and it brings so much joy to people. It's a damaged industry, and she certainly felt that as a woman she experienced incredible sexism. But what I have been enjoying, E4 on their YouTube channel did remote comedy from the paddock. 4 15-minute episodes with comedians doing stand-up, doing sketches, characters from home. So this was recorded during lockdown. And the way that I found this is that I found on Lolly Adefope's Twitter her doing a comedy audition to be the next James Bond. And she is brilliantly funny. She sets it up at the beginning. There's a shelf just behind her and she puts Sally Rooney's Normal People on the shelf and then she takes it down again and puts up a potted plant instead. And she's doing the curating her Zoom backdrop. And then she's thrilled to be auditioning for the part of James Bond, but then you never hear anybody else speak, but basically she reacts as if somebody is responding to her. And she corrects her and she's auditioning for the part of Black James Bond. At some point, again, this phantom voice, her response is, that's a whole continent. So she's obviously being asked to do an African accent. Oh, it's just funny. It really made me laugh. So watch the whole series, but you could also just go to Lolly Adefope's Twitter and lol at her. There's also a woman called Caitlin Riley, who is American. I don't know where she's from. I found her on Instagram. She made me hate. She did Wedding Vows of the Girl Who Bullied You in High School. And you know when people you hate are talking about their love story and it's like they think they're in The Notebook and they're doing this whole narrative of like, when we met, who would have known? And those people that just think that their love is special and that everyone thinks their love is special. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it because I could relate to it a lot. I know people like that. She also does one that's the female lead in every dance movie who's just like breaking into dance as she speaks. Sorry that listeners can't see this, but I just did like a sort of snake arm for Frankie. Anyway, just been having a little lol at some comedians. And then go incredibly lowbrow. I have been watching a show on Netflix that I don't need to describe. I need only say the name for you to know exactly what it is about. It is called Warrior Nun. It's on Netflix. It's sort of a little bit Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's a little bit Kill Bill.
Wow.
With like a vendetta sort of element. It's great. It's great. You're not going to learn anything.
And is she dressed in a nun's habit?
She isn't yet. I haven't watched the full series. However, there is a... what would you call them? I don't know what the collective noun is for a group of nuns. I'm just going to Google that.
I have learnt this, but I've also forgotten it. Is it a habit of nuns?
No. Oh, I hope it's a habit. Where's nuns? Okay. I'm going to call them a troop, because that's what they are. So there are fighting nuns, and you get to see women dressed as nuns doing combat drills.
Fantastic.
And wielding shotguns. It's bizarre. It's a bit supernatural.
Okay.
It's a good watch.
Oh, I'm going to take your word for it.
That's it. That is all we have time for, because I need to find out what happens to the nuns. Thank you so much for listening and joining us. If you have enjoyed what you've heard, please do rate and review and subscribe to our podcast.
You can also sign up to our weekly newsletter, which comes out every Sunday at thewingwoman.co.uk.
And you can follow us on Instagram. Frankie's at Frankie Gradden. I'm at Charlie Gowans. And we are collectively at thewingwoman_.
Until next week.
Bye.